is for dinner parties. It doesn't cut into people's weekend plans, and yet folks are willing to go a little late knowing that they have only one day left in the work week. I marveled at Jim's ability to make simplicity so elegant. I found the same quality in Jim's architecture and designs. His studio had a long bench covered in velvet along one wall and a few black leather cubes to sit on. We'd be served champagne. Light jazz music would play in the background. The dinner guests tended to be a fascinating mix of artists and writers and musicians. To eat, we'd walk 5 steps to a small, simple wooden table with no tablecloth, adorned with 2 silver candles. The chairs were fold-out. Each plate had a big bowl of homemade chili on it and a torn-off piece of fresh bread. For dessert, he would serve ice cream and more champagne. It was simply perfect. And perfectly simple. Anyone can throw a dinner party. Let me give you an example. My former business manager, Mark Ramsey. I first met Mark when he was an accountant for another business manager who specialized in entertainment clients. He was an unhappy camper back then, and he wanted to break out on his own. After mustering enough courage at the age of 25, he opened his own operation. I became his first client. Mark became a regular at my dinner parties in New York. As a client and a friend, Mark would return the favor by inviting me out to dinner or to see a show. After a few years, however, I asked Mark, "So what's up with not having me over to your home for dinner?" A meal at someone's home, after all, is what I enjoy most. His answer was all too common, especially among the younger people I mentor. He told me, "I could never do a dinner party like yours. I don't have that kind of money, and I live in a run-down studio. I don't even have a dining table." "Dining table? Who needs a dining table?" I said. With that, I convinced Mark to give it a try. I told him I'd be his anchor guest and suggested that he invite 4 others for dinner. I told him to get some simple wine, but plenty of it. For appetizers, set out chips and salsa or dip with vegetables. Buy a foldable round tabletop that one can easily find and place it on the coffee table. Voila! You've got yourself a grand dining table. For food, I told him, forget about cooking. Get some salads and a roasted chicken from the deli. For dessert, buy some cookies and ice cream and keep the wine flowing. The party was a huge success. Mark invited a potential client, me, and a friend I brought along. All 4 of us are now his clients. You see, there's only one real rule to these get-togethers. Have fun. All right, there are a few other rules that might help you along the way. Among them, 1. Create a theme. There is no reason that a small dinner party should not have a theme. One simple idea can help you pull the food and atmosphere together. You can build a party around anything, really. It could be your mother's meatloaf recipe, a holiday, black tie, used rarely as we want people to be totally comfortable, vegan food, specific music, whatever you like. People will get jazzed when they know you're being creative. I remember one example of a theme being put to good use that comes from an article I read years ago in the Washington Post about a woman named Perdita Houston. When President Carter appointed Houston Regional Director of the Peace Corps for North Africa, the Near East, Asia, and the Pacific in 1978, she started her weekly for women-only dinner parties. The dinner parties filled a void for Houston, who explained how she came up with the idea. "Because of the size of the region I administered for the Peace Corps, I was obliged to do much traveling. When I wasn't out of town on Peace Corps business, I thought it important to be at home with my son, Pierre, who was then 7 years old. Also because of my travels, I began losing touch with many of my friends. But instead of trying to see people one-on-one in restaurant situations, I devised this scheme of giving weekly dinner parties. Right about the same time, I also came to realize there were a lot of women in my situation, single women in high-level jobs whose professional lives were presenting certain problems and often overwhelming their private lives. In many ways, the women in the Carter administration were pioneers who needed supportive networking, so I decided to limit my guests to women only. What I did was simply expand my Sunday cooking to include preparations for a Monday night meal for 12. I would often make couscous or a lamb-based soup, which is used during Ramadan in Algeria to break the fast at sundown. It's called chorba, which means soup. In fact, it's called the soup. It's very spicy and good enough to be an entire meal. Often I would just prepare a huge tureen of it, along with hot bread and a big salad. Desserts were simply fruit and cheese. The response to my Monday night for women-only dinner was really overwhelming, she continued. I always use my finest china and crystal and silver candlesticks. In other words, I treated these occasions the way most hostesses treat conventional male-female dinner parties. Our dinner table conversations are unusually candid. We talk or argue about U.S. foreign policy or discuss problems common to women in management positions, such as how to combat stereotypes or sexism in the workplace. We get a lot of feedback from each other, and because of our experience, can suggest various people to see, organizations to contact, or strategies to develop. Because they are so supportive, these dinners have become very important to many of us. Houston's weekly parties became an institution in the Washington, D.C. area where she lived. It brought like-minded women together who bonded and supported one another through the similar trials and tribulations each was going through. There's no reason you can't do the same thing. Creating a theme around a point of commonality, be it race, religion, gender, occupation, or anything else, can infuse your get-togethers with added purpose and help you attract others. 2. Use invitations. While I'm all for slapdash impromptu parties, the dinner parties that will be most successful will be those you've devoted some time and energy to, whether by phone, email, or handwritten note. Be sure to get your invites out early, at least a month in advance, so people can have a chance to plan accordingly, and so you'll know who is and who is not coming. 3. Don't be a kitchen slave. There's no sense in a party being all work. If you can't hire a caterer, either cook all the food ahead of time or just use takeout. If the food is good and the presentation snazzy, your guests will be impressed. These days, I usually opt for a caterer. But you can have a similarly elegant party for much less if you're willing to get creative and spend some time preparing. The key to low-budget dinner parties is to keep it simple. Make one large dish, like a stew or chili, that can be prepared a day or two ahead of time. Serve it with great bread and salad. That's all you need. Well, maybe not all you need. My other expense is alcohol. I love, love great wine. I always go a little overboard with the vino. And really, could God have blessed us with a better social lubricant? It amounts to the finest party favor ever created. But again, everyone has their own predilections. And I'm sure you can pull off a perfectly fabulous dinner party with just soda. 4. Create atmosphere. Make sure to spend an hour or two gussying up your place. Nothing expensive or out of the ordinary, mind you. Candles, flowers, dim lighting, and music set a good mood. Add a nice centerpiece to the dinner table. Get a young family member to walk around serving drinks if you don't have a bartender or waiter. The point is to give your guests all the signals they need to understand that it's time to enjoy. 5. Forget being formal. Most dinner parties don't call for anything fancy. Follow the KISS principle. Keep it simple, silly. Good food. Good people. Lots of wine. Good conversation. That's a successful dinner party. I always underdress, just so no one else feels they did. Jeans and a jacket are my standard fare. But you judge for yourself. 6. Don't seat couples together. The essence of a good dinner party lies in seating everyone properly. If you seat couples together, things can get boring. Mix and match, putting people together who don't know each other, but perhaps share an interest of some kind. I like to set placeholders where I want people to sit. Each placeholder is a simple card with the guest name on it. If I have the time, I love to put an interesting question or joke on the back of the card that guests can use to break the ice with one another. Or you can go out and buy funny greeting cards, just to make things interesting. 7. Relax. Guests take their cues from the host. If you're having fun, odds are that they will too. The night of the party, your job is to enjoy all the fruits of your labor. That's an order. 8. Host a virtual after party. After an event, send your thanks along with a few photos and party highlights around via email, BCCing everyone, or a private link. This friendly follow-up helps to pour water on all the seeds of connection planted at the event, and prompts your guests to do their own follow-up. They'll be thankful. 4. Connecting in the Digital Age. Chapter 22. Tap the Fringe. A quote from Charles Eames. Eventually everything connects. People, ideas, objects. The quality of the connections is the key. Recently at one of my dinners, my friend went on a rant about social media. I'm drowning, Keith. I have a news feed full of junk when I don't even have time for the people in my real life, he said. Why do I need all these fake online friends when I have real ones? People at the table were nodding their heads. I get it. We want technology to connect us closer to people we want to meet, things we want to learn, and opportunities we want to have. Instead, we get flooded with people's useless personal output. One friend's sudden desire for a hot pastrami sandwich, endless selfies and close-ups of beloved pets, Zagat-rated meals, and leaky sinks. But there's a solution here. While you may have perfected your Christmas card list and your favorites list, chances are you've ignored the management of one of the most essential facets of your network, those outer reaches that we access and manage through technology. Let's call it the fringe. The fringe has always been important, but in the era of social media, it is exponentially more so. When you manage the fringe effectively, it will feed you timely, powerful, relevant, yet often unexpected information. Of course, in the time you took to read that, three cheesy inspirational quotes and a picture of ingrown hair came through your feed. Let's fix that. Take a look at a handful of the tweets that have come through my newsfeed in the past days. At Michael Hyatt, very cool, an iPhone voice memo app that just works, by at Stu McLaren. At Cory Booker, I've run towards challenges my whole career. Now I want to take on Washington. Watch my first ad for U.S. Senate. At Hummel, Chris, R.I.P. to the greatest teacher in my life, Margaret Metzger's obituary by the Boston Globe. At Tony Robbins, teenager invents flashlight powered by the warmth of your hand. At Shawnstitutional, at Dennis Neal, pro tip. You can order anything with a fresh egg instead of powdered at McD's. Worth the sound of exasperation from cashier. At Guy Kawasaki, social entrepreneurs. Check out this free offer from Wharton. At Cisco Collab, senior executives weigh in on how hashtag cloud, hashtag collaboration, helps grow business in this hashtag infographic. At Accenture, Telenor selects Accenture to implement global shared services vision. Now you might look at all that and decide it's not a particularly interesting set of information, but to me it is. And that's just the point. I've structured and curated my online network to deliver people, information, and opportunities that are completely specific to me and what I'm working on. In just that stretch of tweets, I found a useful tool, exactly the app I've been looking for to organize the notes I dictate to myself in line, at airports, in cabs, etc. A reminder to help a friend. Cory Booker's tweet reminded me that I need to shoot out some emails on his behalf. Personal news affecting a client. An important client was having a sad day. I made a note to ping him for a personal chat to share stories. I felt the same way when Pat LeCanto died. Client news. A client won new business. I'll note this to congratulate their team in our next meeting. A helpful airport tip. I don't even know this tweeter, but you can bet I'm going to try out his tip next time I'm doing an airport breakfast flyby with extremely limited options. Something little like that can really make a difference in my day. Something to share at home. I love inspiring stories for when we sit down to dinner, and Tony's story about a teenage inventor will impress my son, even if he rolls his eyes. Inevitable. An infographic of interest. Virtual teamwork and collaboration is front and center for me now, and I have a potential client whom I'll forward this to. It riffs perfectly off a conversation we had at our last meeting and gives me a great reason to check in. As I scan through my email, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook, I might read a white paper from Accenture, followed by an op-ed on combining philanthropy with for-profit business, followed by a New Yorker cartoon, and so on. Some of these I'll forward on to others in my network. In curating my stream, I've shaped what Taylor Cowen, a top economics blogger and author, calls the daily self-assembly of synthetic experiences. I call it my learning network. Looking at all this seemingly disparate information in aggregate, I see patterns, make connections, and from it all, generate my own little eurekas about myself and the world. It's a stream of data representing the work of real people, so that every bit and byte I read and respond to is also sowing new threads of social capital through my network. In those same moments that I'm getting smarter, I'm also getting better connected. The power of the fringe. It used to be that a few VIPs controlled all the best information, and the rest of us scrambled to get access. Creating relationships with these people got you info almost as privileged as the kind that gets people jailed for insider trading. Knowing the right people, and making sure they know you, will always be important, but these days the playing field is much more level. Information loses value so quickly that it makes more sense to trade it than hoard it, so bankable information is free-flowing, gushing, online.
learn to tap its value, and you're as privileged as the people who can open all the right doors. To do that requires you to learn how to build and manage the broad frontier of your social graph. The periphery of your network, made up of weak, even unconnected ties, where so much of the innovation and value now reside. These days you're no longer restricted by time and space. You can navigate a boundless virtual geography. You can flit in and out of a stable of engineers in New Delhi, or mountain trekkers in Chile, guided by nothing but shared interests and curiosity, and plugging instantaneously, click, into not just a particular person's mind, but the collective mind share of his or her entire network. Tools to measure this new advantage are still rough, but the effect is plain. We now have in Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn what amounts to a simple dashboard that vividly displays the power, or lack thereof, of your own network. Does your stream, your flow of content from intimates and the fringe alike, make you laugh, provide support, surprise, and educate you, promote wellness, find you jobs? It can, and it should. You can now wield the intelligence of a crowd that scales well beyond the number of actual relationships you can cultivate. And both its breadth and its design matter. Meet a new breed of networker. Years ago, people thought I was nuts because I had 5,000 contacts in my Rolodex. Now it's commonplace. And the crazy ones are those who ignore the value of weak ties. Even so, I'm not even the best or the most advanced master of leveraging the fringe through social media. In other words, I'm no Robert Scoble. Scoble represents a new breed of networker native to the digital era. He's a tech evangelist who was once famous in the tech world as Microsoft's in-house blogger. Now he's Rackspace's startup liaison, spending his days meeting startup founders and blogging about them. He is the sixth most influential social media power influencer, according to Forbes. But lately, he's most famous for photographing himself in the shower wearing his Google glasses. If you're curious, he's no millennial. He's 48. Proof that mastering the fringe isn't just for people who had a Facebook page and then their first kiss. Scoble is a master at curating a massive fringe network, 40K and counting, hand-added people he follows on Twitter alone, creating a flow of incredibly valuable technology intel. And 40K is just his inbound network, those people he's chosen to follow. His outbound network is around 400K. Here's how he works. He and I both attend the World Economic Forum meeting at Davos. When I'm at the event, the bulk of my focus is on making connections that I plan to develop into relationships. When I meet someone new, I want as little in between us as possible, which means putting my devices and theirs away. All my energies go into finding that one thing that's going to make clear that we need to meet again, assuming we do. Then the phone comes out again. You know, I've got a guy. Scoble has a completely different focus. He's a man-on-the-scene reporter. He quickly parses who to talk to, teases out useful information, adds people to his Twitter if he thinks they're worthy, which at Davos, of course, they all are, and delivers the intel in the form of interview videos and commentary to all of his fans and followers. I have no deep relationships with anyone, he'll tell you. Is he a networking jerk? Actually, no. He's just a guy whose singular focus is on mining value from the fringe. Scoble is well-loved in the tech community, where he operates, and you'll often hear him called a nice guy. He has hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter. He has a geek's dream job, scouring the world for world-changing startups. But the real pay dirt of it all isn't in a new friend or colleague. It's in the aggregate, the constantly expanding fringe network that contributes to his newsfeed. He is providing value, incredible value, despite the fact that his broad network isn't social and it isn't personal. Yet it is both tremendously valuable and reciprocal by design. No one's forced to follow him, and yet hundreds of thousands do, because he's a source for quality information about what's important to them. Technology. While I had my hustle on at Davos one year, working furiously, as I always do, against the list of people I want to meet, Scoble was being wined and dined by big-time venture guys trying to bring him into their new fund. They need to know what he knows, his immersive learning from swimming 24/7 in that carefully curated inbound stream of information on startups and tech trends. And on top of that, they want other people to know that they know what he knows. It's a Laurel and Hardy act with big returns. So if you think Scoble's intel is valuable only to the Yahoos, the unconnected outsiders who follow him for the precious access he offers, you're dead wrong. You don't have to become Scoble, but from him, we can take away some hard rules for building and leveraging the optimal fringe network through social media. Become the canary in the mineshaft. If, as a kid, you had the chicken pox, you know well how quickly disease can spread through a network. Thanks to the research of network scientists, we now know that ideas are just as contagious. The more ideas that infect you, the more likely you'll catch hold of the one that becomes the key to the next big innovation. To guarantee you'll catch the information flu, create a dense network with yourself in the center. That's exactly why venture guys want to buddy up with Scoble. He's what Harvard Medical School professor Nicholas Christakis calls a sensor, meaning that he has the ideal network to ensure that he'll be the first to catch wind of the next great startup or cool new tech innovation. We live our lives in networks. Being conscious about shaping that network determines the value of the information that will come your way. So turn your network into a petri dish with you smack in the middle of it. Social media allows you to create a dense web of relationships within your industry that fans out in every direction, all conduits leading back to you. The growing superpower of weak ties. In the past decade, I probably spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even millions, on assistance and data entry to capture and leverage all those weak ties at the fringe. But I was an outlier. Now the internet allows anyone with just a little bit of conscientiousness to capture, track, and interact with these relationships efficiently. And at scale. This is really an extraordinary thing. In an earlier chapter, we learned from Mark Granovetter about the singular benefits of weak ties. Information is flowing, and with it, innovation, as never before. Again, this doesn't invalidate the importance of strong ties, not at all. You need your friends, and what I call lifelines, deeply committed to professional relationships, as much as ever. But when it comes to social media, the new big win isn't in maintaining 250 relationships, but 25,000 relationships. So how do you manage your online life to successfully identify, target, connect, and leverage the fringe? Turn the volume up. Get over your fear of scale. The most common and unfortunate misconception about networking these days is that connecting broadly to the fringe somehow devalues your real friendships. Nonsense. The fact is, network management scales easily, while intimacy almost always requires one-on-one. Most critics conflate the two, huffing something like, "See, look at what social media has done. These kids today have 5,000 friends, but no real relationships." Meanwhile, the kids, those doing it right, who refuse the notion that the two concepts must be mutually exclusive, have a small core of very strong, intimate relationships, and a large, diverse network from which they can pull the resources, information, and people they require to address unexpected needs. So go big, but create a structure to help you curate and filter, along with habits that distinguish signal from noise. And don't follow just anyone. As Scoble has said of the people he's following, "I knew why I wanted to follow them. I only follow early adapters, innovators, executives, or influencers in the tech industry. I don't follow a lot of sports stars. I don't follow a lot of movie stars. I don't follow a lot of politicians." My own guide is my Relationship Action Plan, RAP. Make it yours, too. I always have my goals front and center, on my desk and in my phone, directing the evolution of my network and how I'm using social media. The trick is making the shift back and forth between the 50 or 150 folks who are front and center in your RAP, with whom you want to build real intimate relationships, and that broader scaled network that brings you new ideas and information. Technology makes it a lot easier to juggle both, so that when your RAP goals change, you're able to draw from the larger network to shift the focus of your smaller network and nurture a different core group of relationships. You're always building and keeping an ear on the larger network while focusing your relationship energies on a smaller group. I handle this flow the same way I do with pinging, by creating fluid categories and priority ratings. All the major social platforms allow you to do this through tagging or lists. My social media ones tend to be straight off my immediate RAPs, so they're people I'm looking to interact with personally, online and off. The twos and threes, meanwhile, are the fringe. Most of my interaction with them is through broadcast interactions such as tweets, blogs, and my newsletter. And yet, I scan the three feed regularly. It's where I get some of my best ideas and information. Emphasize diversity. Network diversity, it turns out, boosts collective intelligence. That's what University of Michigan professor Scott E. Page concluded after 20 years of research. For example, Page has shown that if you put a room full of, say, doctors next to a room full of people from diverse fields, the collective intelligence of the diverse group will be higher than the homogeneous one, even if each of the doctors individually had higher IQs. The individuals in the high IQ group might have been smarter, but when it came to measuring collective intelligence, diversity matters more than individual brain power, as Stephen Berlin Johnson put it in his book Future Perfect. The need to cast your net broadly in your sweep for new friends isn't just about smarts. It's about growth on a deeper level. As the change management guru and Fast Company co-founder William Taylor has written, "What you see shapes how you change. Every one of us has at some point gotten stuck in a rut when it comes to how we see the world and our place in it. We tell ourselves a story of what our job is, what our company does, who the people we work with are, and that story becomes our reality. We let what we know limit what we can imagine. The result? A failure of imagination. What could your job be? Where might your company go if only it had a new direction? How might you approach your next big decision if you were surrounded by a few X's instead of all Y's? What you see shapes how you change. And in social media, as in the real world, I'd add this. Where you look shapes what you see. So find ways to build diversity into your online network. This is particularly easy online, and yet few people bother. Their networks have grown organically from family, school, and work, and it ends up turning their news feeds into the social media equivalent of a TV channel that plays nothing but reruns. Here are some suggestions specific to turning up the creative juju you're getting from your stream. Quickly audit your news feed and whatever else is on your daily read. Is there diversity of background, profession, location, age, and ethnicity? If not, pull some of your network's outlying relationships to the fore. Over time, explore new activities that take you out of your traditional channels to make new friends. See the earlier chapter, Find Anchor Tenants and Feed Them. Make a dedicated fringe list on Twitter and Facebook. Artists, entrepreneurs, technologists, jugglers, whatever. Anyone else of interest who's not on your usual hit list. Schedule time into your weekly workflow to peruse it. Look at what these folks are linking to and sharing to expand your list. Study the blogs, books, and trade media of interesting professionals and leaders in other fields to see what's working for them, and then consciously think about how you can apply their ideas to your challenges. Lift and shift, as the innovation wonks are now putting it. The best online filter is offline. Scoble is famous for being a geek, but don't mistake him for the kind of guy who's fused to his desk chair. His most important filter for adding people to his network happens in the real world, at the conferences and industry parties where he's a constant presence. He vets people offline by having relationships with a lot of people for an hour at a time, he says. At parties, I go straight up to somebody I don't know and start talking to them because I realize that's how I'm going to build my network. Scoble is not just a Twitter expert. He's an expert at quickly figuring out what kind of information someone has to offer him. Knowing who people are, what company they work for, what they get passionate about, and what role they play in life has let me build an inbound network that's pretty extraordinary at this point, he says. Face-to-face, we have access to a much richer data stream about people, what they look like, how they carry themselves, whether they say tomato or a tomato, and so on. But there's more to it than that. Physical meetings, during which we can't cloak ourselves in anonymity or edit ourselves before hitting send, have more authenticity, and that alone promotes trust, as does, potentially, the context in which you meet. The best online networking crosses back and forth between virtual and real, without overemphasizing either. As a rule of thumb, let offline guide initial connections and use online interactions for maintenance. It's worth noting that even Scoble, master of the fringe, also has a strategy for keeping in touch with his intimates, and it doesn't happen online. He and his best buds meet every 3 weeks for beers and catch-up time. Embrace micro-celebrity. Have you ever heard of Natalie Molina Nino? Probably not. But if you were a young female entrepreneur in New York City, there's a strong chance you would have. I came across her only because a reader in New York once forwarded me an issue of her newsletter that she'd thought I'd like. Molina Nino is a micro-celebrity. Not famous among millions, but famous among the people who are important to her life's mission, which is helping women start their own businesses. As the founder and curator of TEDx Barnard College Women, she's the fuel core of a network that makes it easy for her to identify and tap the resources to get stuff done, and done quickly. Her efforts have put her in cahoots with some big kahunas, people like Gloria Felt, the CEO of Planned Parenthood, Shark Tank real estate mogul Barbara Corcoran, and Kitty Colbert, director of Barnard's Athena Center, and the lawyer who argued the landmark case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey, credited with saving Roe versus Wade. These are women who can help her make an even bigger difference. Molina Nino's breed of fame wasn't won by viral video, although people do look forward to the daily Facebook pictures of her two chow dogs out and about in New York City. She provides the singular service of organizing the disorganized, creating community out of disparate network nodes. Guess where that puts her? Right at the center of the petri dish. Bing! She's a super connector. Micro-celebrity, or really the work that goes into creating it, strengthens relationships with the people in your relationship action plan while keeping you connected to the fringe at the same time. By creating your RAP, you have the schematic of a new network. Who among them might you introduce to each other? You, of course, will benefit by bringing that network closer together, but so will everyone else within it. Now build on that. Find ways to connect that group to one another and to others who would benefit from knowing them. Think email lists, LinkedIn groups, Facebook interest pages, dinners with speakers, workshops, peer coaching groups. Shifting from virtual to the real world is needed to build momentum and depth. Together, find ways to create value. Sharing information is a great place to start. Identify the hidden and well-known experts whom your micro-network needs to know and make it your business to connect them. Find the research, the news, and the events that are relevant to this group, and be the first to share them. Create content together. Getting people, resources, and opportunities in sync is easier than it ever has been, thanks to the Internet. This is the project of our times. What will be your contribution? Find the answer and reap the reward. The value of the little fish. If you're a relative up-and-comer, don't put all your social media focus on trying to woo celebrities or major influencers. You want to connect online to the big players, I know. But if you spend all your time trying to attract the attention of Richard Branson or Mark Cuban with your most clever tweets, you're betting on the wrong horse. Your chances of getting their attention are slim, and although I do believe there are ways to be generous to anybody, it can be difficult when Twitter or Facebook is your only tool. Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn, gets 50 cold emails a day from people who want to pitch him. Do you know how many of those pitches he's invested in? Zero. Because he's got 50 more pitches from people who come recommended. Keep in mind, too, that the VIPs of the fringe aren't always the same folks as they are in the real world. They're the little guys, the scrappy outsiders. These are the people who are hungry and driven by passion for their work, uninhibited by the expectations and culture of the big leaguers. So forget the big kahuna when you're starting from scratch. Instead, spend your time trying to suss out tomorrow's big kahuna. Don't look where everybody else is looking, with all the typical filters, formal credentials, Twitter follower counts, expensive web design. Instead, look for great ideas, uncommon smarts, fresh faces, and an openness to a two-way relationship. Build the alliance, and hopefully in 5 or 10 years, you'll each be in a better position to help each other. And even if he or she doesn't become the next Sean Parker, you'll have another really smart friend in your corner, always an investment with great returns. Taming the LinkedIn beast. You're doing it all wrong, Keith. That is, in essence, what Reid Hoffman told me when I told him how I was using LinkedIn. Because I'm an author and speaker, new people find me on Twitter and Facebook and follow me every day without my doing a thing. That's not how it works on LinkedIn, where I have to accept new connections. LinkedIn is a closed network, and for a very simple reason. For the network to have value as an introduction tool, the connections need to have meaning. It's up to you to vet each and every request, so that if someone comes to you and says, "Would you introduce me?" you're in a position to evaluate whether the connection would be of mutual benefit. For years, I just said yes to everybody who sent a connection request, patting myself on the back as the contacts piled up. But because now all those strangers are in there, I frequently find myself in the awkward situation of having one person I don't know asking me to introduce them to another person I don't know. This never happens to me in the real world. So learn from me. Connect only to people whom you know enough about to feel confident introducing them to others in your network. They don't need to have passed a background check, but they should be more than a random data point. You should be glad to help them out if they come to you for a quick favor. And you should feel comfortable doing the same. Master the art of introductions on LinkedIn, and you'll quickly ascend to super connector status. The site tracks first, second, and third degree connections. That means it offers the potential of connecting to hundreds of thousands of new contacts, if you do so thoughtfully. In his book, The Startup of You, Reid suggests making at least one quality introduction a month. If you can make them valuable, I'd say double that. And when you reach out on the site, show people you've read their profile by directly referencing it. On the online dating site OkCupid, the emails that get the most responses are the ones that say things like, "You mention," or "I noticed that." In other words, phrases that showed that the person had carefully read the other's profile, writes Reid. In dating, as in business, the high-touch approach beats the generic come-on every time. Addicted to likes. If you're having trouble being intentional in your use of social media, you're not alone. Facebook is the chocolate of the internet. Literally. Talking about ourselves and gobbling up the likes that follow triggers a dopamine rush. The reward and pleasure centers of our brains light up like Christmas trees. People like to blame technology for turning us into mindless addicts, but the truth is, we've always been mindless addicts. Life is stressful, and sometimes a ho-ho just does the trick. Insert your own drug of choice. Social media is just one more tasty treat, available now in incredible overabundance. I like to take occasional day-long breaks from the internet and the devices that deliver it for reading and writing. It's never easy at first, but even my hepped-up brain adapts more rapidly than you'd expect. Most of my social media time I reserve for moments that would otherwise be unproductive. Planes, trains, and automobiles. These are the same little snatches of time I use for pinging. Introduce mindfulness in your social media strategy. When you log on, especially during the workday, make sure it's time that adds up to progress on your goals. Understand the opportunity. I was driving the other day in Los Angeles and pulled up to a stop sign. In the driver's seat of the car next to me was a girl staring into her iPhone. Seemingly, what was there was more useful to her than paying attention to signs on the street, or geez, the traffic moving all around her. We both sat there waiting for a pedestrian to cross. He was taking forever, and why do you suppose? Because he, like the driver next to me, had already arrived at his most important destination, the smartphone in his hand. I watched his thumb scroll and scroll, face glued to the screen, totally oblivious to everything else. The scroll beat the stroll. Hands down. People these days live in their news feeds. The unstoppable force of its magnetism invites all kinds of social woes. Most notably, it makes for bad drivers and even worse dinner guests. But that's the reality we live in. So if you're a person who wants to attract attention, whether of customers, colleagues, or even friends, you better learn to communicate in that little feed that's flowing by as fast as fingers can page the screen. That's where you can most easily add value. It's where they're constantly looking for it. Share great info, make them laugh or cry. There's lots of ways to stand out. Find yours and stick to it. That's what the next chapter on content is all about. This has never been more important, because here's one thing you can be sure of when it comes to your next customer or connection. Their eyes are on their feed. Chapter 23. Become the King of Content. No matter how big technology helps you build your network, no matter how much information you compile, forward motion on your dreams will hit a wall if you can't build trust. To build trust online, beyond that limited circle of people you can touch personally, you need to find a way to reveal your humanity in bits and bytes. And to do it so well that you could connect to someone if you are transmitting to them from outer space. It can be done. It has been done. Chris Hadfield is a Canadian astronaut who finished up his stint on the International Space Station in 2013, when it was being crowded out of headlines by commercial space efforts like Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic. No one was paying attention until Hadfield started tweeting about his personal experience of the day-to-day of space station life. One popular video showed what it's like to cry in space. He broke even bigger and got people crying on Earth when he tweeted links to a zero-gravity music video of him performing David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust. Even Bowie gave him the virtual high-five, a Twitter retweet. Meanwhile, five other astronauts were up there with him. I couldn't tell you one of their names. What we're talking about is content, the one true vehicle for building trust online. Content is how people come to know who you are, what you're about, what you want, what you can provide, whether you're cool, etc. Articles, blog posts, profiles, status updates, every bit and byte that's produced and associated with you and your name adds up to something. The web is no longer just about the present, that crazy driver or this delicious meal. As we share messages, photos, and updates, we're building a data trail about our lives and histories online. We can now tell stories, not just about what is happening today, but where we've been, what we've shared, and what might happen in the future. Those who figure out the best way to curate all those bits and bytes, and to do so through the right channels at the right time, will create the largest and productive networks, generate the most and the best opportunities, and be the most prepared to pivot their careers should the need arise. The algebra of trust. Creating content that gets read and builds trust requires you to adopt and communicate the same core values that help you build relationships in the physical world. Here's my formula. Generosity plus vulnerability plus accountability plus candor equals trust. Too many people make the mistake of thinking that their online content should showcase only how perfect they are, how slick, how put together. They think that whether people trust them will be decided by whether they can assemble the right bona fides or get a great headshot in the right color blouse or shirt. Sure, that stuff can help, but it can only take you so far. A while back, I went to a studio and shot a bunch of videos for an online learning series. I had hair, makeup, lights, my best suit, everything but a row of important-looking books behind my head. I wanted to establish that I was an expert, right? Well, when I watched the video, I saw that the makeup artist, trying his best to shellac over a zit, had turned me into an extra from the show Jersey Shore. I was orange. We ended up redoing the shoot on the fly in my office, where I may not have had the best lights, but I was relaxed and natural and not orange. The videos turned out great. The message here isn't that orange people aren't trustworthy. It's this. The more you can be yourself, the more people will trust that you're giving them the straight dope. It's better to be rough around the edges than polished into a bland sheen. So if you've tried to create an online identity that shows you're a smooth, connected player and have either thrown up your hands in despair or felt like a fraud, relax and try something new. Explore radical honesty. The finance meets spirituality guru, James Altucher, is a guy who has turned his rough edges into a content empire. Altucher isn't smooth, slick, or connected. In fact, his pedigree is a portfolio of astounding failures. His dress is less Wall Street than Occupy Wall Street, if the movement employed an IT guy. And above all, the things Altucher says inevitably piss somebody off, often a lot of somebodies. These seeming demerits have in fact helped Altucher grow a loyal tribe of hundreds of thousands who read his blog. He has opened doors to everyone from the super secretive hedge funder Stephen Cohen to Mad Money's Jim Cramer, and built both enduring relationships and ardent frenemies while reinventing himself and his career in multiple industries, earning and losing hundreds of millions of dollars many times over. Altucher started out with a